Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Tech is provided by AOL Radio at AOL.com/podcasting. This is TWiT, This Week in Tech, episode 183 for February 23rd, 2009. Pirates Circus. This Week in Tech is brought to you by Go to My PC wherever you go. Access your PC and all your files, programs, and email remotely with Go to My PC. For a free trial of this award-winning service, visit gotomypc.com/twit. And by listeners like you. Thanks so much for your contribution. We couldn't do TWiT without it.
You are the Lepart Truman Show.
And it is exactly what it is. And it's so much fun. It's really, what's neat about it is, of course, podcasting makes it flexible for everyone. You download when you want to listen to it. But it's not interactive. And so it's really nice to have people, so we have 700 people in the chat, one chat room, 500
people
another.
Yelling at you in real time.
Yeah, it's great.
It's just like Jenny Cam.
It's just like Jenny Cam. Gee, what happened to her?
I don't know. Married, raising a family.
How old is your baby? I want to say, I don't want to read her whole name.
Posey is one. We call her Poe or Posey. Yeah, she's one. She just turned one. Got the 1 year molars to prove it.
Oh, that's so great. So it's been a year. I think that's right about when you were on last time then.
Yeah, it's been a busy year. Last 14, 15 months, we changed continents. My wife changed jobs. We had a baby, published a book, went on a book tour, published two more books, wrote two books. We spent a month in Asia researching a book, got married three times on two continents, went on my honeymoon.
So, what a great year it's been.
Been a busy 15 or 16 months.
We welcome him back for the first time in about that long, Cory Doctorow of craphound.com. Of course, a great novelist. What's your new book, Little Brother?
The book that I'm working on now is called For the Win, and it's about union organizers and gold farms. The next book I've got coming out is a book for grown-ups called Makers. And then the book that just came out last year was called Little Brother, and it's a young adult novel. It's doing really well. It's in its eighth hardcover printing.
Wow. And you did the same thing with that you've done with your other novels? You Creative Commons licensed it and released it?
Absolutely, yeah.
And it's still in its eighth hardcover printing, folks.
Oh, yeah. New York Times bestseller. Everyone's bestseller lists up for all the awards.
Just shows you. Great. Now, will you call For the Win FTW just to...
That's the code name as we speak. That's, the file is called FTW.txt.
I love it. Also with us, Ryan Block from GDGT. Great to talk to you, Ryan.
Hey, thanks for having me back.
Always great to have you back on the show. And now I'm just wondering if there is any strife in the Block household when Veronica became a Twitter-suggested celebrity.
We all know that she's the celebrity in the family,
leaving the rest of us in the dust.
I'm just happy to be associated and to get that little bit of runoff.
Well, it's great to have you. I actually invited Ryan and Peter Rojas, and we will get you both on another time. But just Peter responded too late, and I'd already booked the panel up. But we'll get you two on again then soon, maybe next week. Who knows?
Yeah, we're not going anywhere.
Good. Also, so pleased to have him on, Robert Herron. An original TWiT. He was on the very first TWiT episode, many subsequent to that. And then my fault, Robert, entirely. I'm so glad to have you back on.
Hey, we're busy people. Thanks. Thanks for inviting me.
The occasion is kind of sad because DLTV went into hiatus last week.
Unnecessary hiatus. It really was just a personnel thing, just not having enough bodies to get stuff done and basically getting that to everyone's attention who needed it to be, who needed to be told. So we're working on it.
So the plan is, it really is a hiatus and not a cancellation. The plan is to bring it back.
Totally. Totally.
Good. I'm glad.
Along with continuing all the other content we're doing through the relationship we have with Mevio and PC Mag as well, including Dvorax, great cranky geeks.
He's still doing that.
He is. He's nonstop.
Yeah. And, you know, there have been personnel changes there as well, as we all know.
Totally. And, you know, it's partially the economy, about getting everyone on the same page in terms of what we need to do to make it a better show for everyone.
Good. Good. I'm glad to hear it. I'm also really glad, and I'm going to add her right now, to welcome. This is a big panel today, so I'm going to have to ask everybody
to be polite and to let other people talk. Gina Trapani, who I've been a big fan of for ages, ever since she created the most singularly useful blog in history, lifehacker.com. And she's kind of semi-retired from Lifehacker. We'll ask her about that. And has a new site that we're going to let her talk about. Gina is on the phone, I think. Hi, Gina.
Hi, how are you?
I'm calling you on Skype. Oh, I have you on Skype.
Yes, you just got me on Skype. Just switched from my cell phone.
It's so cool. So we had her in two different locations. Glad to have you on. Let me introduce you around because I've been introducing everybody, but we're getting due to my, I put a dot instead of a dash in your
name.
Yeah,
that was my fault. I think I told you the wrong thing. My apologies.
It's like Morse code. There's a big world of difference between a dot and a dash. Also with us on the line, Cory Doctorow. He's in London right now where it's late at night.
Hey, Cory.
Yes, hello.
And how you doing, Gina?
Good. How are you?
Tired.
You two, actually, between the two of you, have the biggest blogs in the world, Boing Boing and Lifehacker. Come to think of it.
Well, I've got the largest blog in the world called Boing Boing.
He does. Cory does. Cory beat me out in that sector.
And I'm the biggest podcaster that's on video 30 hours a week at Twit Live. So we're all, you know, in good company. Also with us, Robert Herron from DLTV, my old friend. Longtime screensavers and lab rat guy.
And, hey, hello. Pleasure to meet everybody.
And Ryan Block from Engadget. Do you know everybody, Gina? Are these strangers to you?
Yes, to varying degrees. Robert, you and I haven't met. Ryan, no. I can't believe we haven't met, but Cory and I have certainly met.
Yeah, it's really surprising that we haven't crossed paths before now. But
That's the best thing about.
He's great at connecting people. That's what he does.
Well, but you know what? I was about to say it's a great thing about the internet is that you can get to know people, you can read their work, you can feel like you're practically buddies with them through things like Facebook and Twitter, and have never met, and then to meet like this is really great, serendipitous. I'd never met Gina, but I've been a fan for years. So,
likewise,
there you go. So, lots to talk about this week. We have such a good group. I guess we should probably. Start with the New Zealand blackout. This is, I'm sure, kind of something Cory Doctorow has something to say about. New Zealand passed a law. In fact, you find out more about this. There's a short URL that I use, tr.im/freedom. That'll take you to the creativefreedom.org.nz blog. New Zealand amended their copyright law with something called Section 92A. And correct me if I'm wrong, Cory, but essentially what 92A says is if somebody complains about you, a record company or movie company, your internet service provider just pulls the plug with no due process. It's done. You're guilty by accusation.
Yeah, so this is actually like not sui generis to New Zealand. This has been a feature of copyright proposals all over the world, in the EU and the UK, something called the counterfeiting trade agreement that the US and the EU and Canada have been negotiating. It's a feature there. And it's this three strikes you're out rule in which if you're accused three times of infringing copyright, they cut off your internet access. So my friend Kevin Marks, who works with me on the advisory council of the Open Rights Group here in the UK and also works at Google, he said, well, why don't we have a three strikes you're out rule for copyright holders? So if someone accuses you three times of making false accusations, we cut off your internet access, right? So like if Universal Music gets accused three times of getting it wrong, we just, you know, we go with the bolt cutters to every Universal branch office in the entire world. We cut off their internet access. From now on, they can be a music label that does all its business by fax.
There you go.
You know? It's pretty it's the thing about this is that it treats your internet access as a thing that you use to get MP3s, as opposed to the single wire that delivers freedom of speech, freedom of the press, and freedom of assembly, your health information, your education, your job, and everything else, and not just for you, but for everyone else in your household. You know, I just got the latest Time Out here in London, and they had an article on life inside one of the most notorious prisons in the United Kingdom, and they asked all these inmates, these convicted felons, what they were doing, and they're all getting degrees at Open University by internet.
Wow.
So these people who've been like convicted of felonies get to use the internet, but people who've been accused of downloading music won't. So you know, it's a really bad piece of policy. It should be a self-evidently bad piece of policy. And you know, the fact that the New Zealand government passed it doesn't reflect well on New Zealand. And, you know, to their credit, the New Zealand geek community, who are big and strong and intelligent and clever, have really brought this to the world's attention. And I think the reason the world needs to pay attention to this is not because, you know, we bleed for our brothers and sisters in New Zealand, although it sucks for them. It's because this is the first of several dominoes that the entertainment industry is hoping will fall.
Is this the first country they've been able to get this three strikes law in effect? Yes,
that's right. There was a bill floated in the American Congress in the last administration that didn't go anywhere. There have been proposals here in the UK, and there's an administrative proposal in the US. I think Sarkozy may have actually gotten it in France. I'm not entirely sure. I know that in the EU, when they talk about it as a model, they call it the French model, the Sarkozy model.
You know, the French are to blame for everything, aren't they?
Yeah. Well, Sarko is like possibly the weirdest ringmaster that ever ran a three-ring government, I tell you what.
In the U.S. Congress, the people who don't like the stimulus bill say it's the Frenchification of America. There's something in the air about France.
So, well, you know, if we brought back the guillotine, maybe for the people who got us into the economic mess, that would be a truly French solution.
I look on my Twitter friends list and I see so many black avatars. This is the protest, is to black out your avatar on Facebook or Twitter or the social network you're on. And it's now through the 23rd. As this podcast comes out, it'll be kind of the last day of the blackout, but the first day of this new law. And I don't know if they're having any success in New Zealand in quashing it, but I'm glad that the attention's being brought to it.
I think it's a 21st century version of the old EFF Blue Ribbon campaign, which is really EFF's first public campaign. And they won, right? CDA, I mean, it took 25 years or whatever, but the Communications Decency Act essentially has been completely gutted as a result of the activism that started with that Blue Ribbon campaign. And I think the important thing to keep in mind here is that repealing the law in New Zealand may not be a big bang. It may be a series of court challenges and other actions that go on for a long time. But by keeping the world's attention focused on what's going on in New Zealand, it will keep us on our toes for when these proposals come to our own home countries.
There is a leaked letter from the RIANZ, the New Zealand Recording Industry Association, that came out 10 days ago. And it's now just being published in Computer Word New Zealand, in which they basically say they want to determine what happens to copyright infringers. They basically want to be the police, the law, and the letter.
So, you know, the amazing thing about these self-help proposals is that the record industries and the film industries own record on self-help, where they've had, you know, because they've had self-help measures with the DMCA where they can send takedown notices and so on. And with the bulk litigation campaign against downloaders shows you just how little care they take, right? So they're arguing, oh, well, we are, you know, sober grown-ups as opposed to those crazy anarchists in their funny black t-shirts that say things that judges don't understand. So, you know, we should be allowed to act as judge, jury, and executioner because we would never fly off the handle and do something weird. We will always behave in a responsible way, except when we're suing like dead people and people who don't own computers and, you know, people
all of which they've done, little old ladies.
People who are in, you know, comas and, you know, there was just a stat released on the number of suicide attempts related to people who've been, kids who've been targeted by the RIAA. I mean, you know, they sent a DMCA disconnection threat to a laser printer at a university that they said was downloading an Indiana Jones movie. Not only is no one suited to replace the judiciary and due process for when it comes to disconnecting people from the internet or any other substantial area of law, but the record and movie industry are especially not suited to replacing the judiciary and the rule of law when it comes to this sort of thing.
Gina, are you a pirate, Gina Trapani? Do you steal music over the internet? Not that you'd ever admit.
I think my Skype connection is a little flaky. Let's talk about that later.
Okay.
Well, I'll tell you what. Every time I give a speech, especially at an entertainment company, because I go to entertainment companies a lot, because, you know, they're not monolithically evil mustache twirlers. They tend to be filled with people who care about this stuff, some of whom think that they're going the wrong way. I always say, is there anyone in this audience who doesn't think of themselves as a copyright pirate? And no one puts their hands up. Disney, no one put their hand up.
Really?
Pam McMillan, no one put their hand up. Everyone knows that they're pirates. I mean, I compare it to like the Victorian taboo against masturbation, where everyone claimed that they never masturbated, and everyone assumed that they were the only hypocrite in the room. You know, one of the nice things about asking that question in public is that when no one's hand goes up, everyone realizes, well,
we're all hypocrites. Yeah.
All hypocrites
right,
here.
Right.
Well, you know, my question is, I mean, I think that you did a really succinct job at kind of summarizing where we're at, but you know, my question is, are we doing enough, right? Are we doing enough to raise awareness? Are the actions that we as a technology community taking enough to really kind of get this stuff out there? I mean, yeah, this topic definitely has its place on a lot of the really geeky blogs, and this blackout avatar thing is something. But is it enough? You know, is this really the kind of attention that is going to actually change that legislation? I mean, we have legal parties who are getting involved, and you know, those legal parties are definitely going to put the pressure on the government officials responsible for this kind of legislation.
But is it enough just to black out your avatar? You're saying,
right? I mean, you
what
know,
more
I,
can
I,
we do?
Like,
I mean, what should we do?
You're asking the wrong person. You know, I would not, you know, call myself a great internet activist, but I mean, something feels like, you know, we need to take this, you know, not to the internet, but to the streets.
Yeah.
It seems more of a complaint just with that type of legislation, just being promoted under pressure from apparently lobbyists. Where's the public discourse in informing those kind of laws?
Well, this is it. I mean, unfortunately, we are.
It seems
able
like
to,
the default, where if you're a business that's under attack, supposedly from some, say, rogue element that's downloading your material or copyright infringement of some kind, it seems like they just automatically get a law put in place.
Now, the problem is that I'm not a New Zealand citizen, so I don't really have standing in New Zealand. So, Corey, what I mean, you know, for the Blue Ribbon campaign, that was a little more straightforward. You could be an activist. You go to EFF and fill out the petition and participate. What do we do as citizens of the world here?
Well, I think that, you know, speaking as like a putting on a movement strategist hat here, what we need is an ecosystem of different kinds of activity from different kinds of people, because there's no one size fits all mode of engagement, and people move through different kinds of engagement as their lives change. You know, when you're a student, you have different priorities and so on. But I, you know, there is that ecosystem now. So there's a group of people who go to the World Intellectual Property Organization in Geneva and negotiate copyright treaties and stand up for that stuff. And I just heard you talking, I think it was, no, someone else talking about this new pharmaceutical deal where they're cutting the rates for pharma in the developing world. That comes straight out of those people. There's right. a group, there are groups of people who take to the streets, including some of the Kiwi activists who are on Parliament Hill shouting and waving placards. There are people on Facebook. There's one absolutely amazing group is the Free Culture Clubs, which are a global network of campus clubs at high schools and universities of students who do all kinds of stuff to promote free culture. Creative Commons and iCommons are two closely related organizations that work on this stuff, recruiting artists, recruiting through Science Commons and CC Learn educators and researchers. So there's really like the you know, I hear what you're saying, Ryan, and I think that that's where the movement has gone in the last like 5 or 6 years, is expanding out from just being EFF and maybe the Free Software Foundation to being this giant ecosystem of organizations and individuals who have different ways to engage. One thing that I'd love to see more of, do you remember a few years ago they had the install Firefox on your parents' computer this Thanksgiving?
Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
I think that there's a movement, that there's an opportunity, a wasting for like a toolkit of things to put on your parents' computers to make them more free and more private every time you go home.
That's a great
for the holidays,
idea.
Like
That's
a Christmas idea. DVD and a Thanksgiving DVD and so on.
You know, I've heard Larry Lessig talk and say, this is not an occasion to become a pirate. This is, you know, resist that urge and instead use your energies to change the laws, not to break them. You agree?
Right. And, you know, it, for me, you know, there isn't, I don't think, an equation that you can put to reaching out directly to legislators. But when you compare knocking on doors, making, you know, writing a physical letter or a fax, you know, calling an office versus sending an email, you know, I mean, emails get thrown in the trash. Emails get filtered. Emails don't really go anywhere. And there's only so much, you know, it's very easy to tune out what's going on online when, you know, you're in a government position and you're living in your little world. So, you know, these legislators tend, I think, to pay attention more to offline type activities. And that doesn't necessarily mean picketing a government building. You know, it means calling. It means writing a letter, right? Things that we don't normally do as people who are spending most of our time on the internet.
Gina, do you think that geeks are a little too insular, and we do things like the blackout avatars? That's easy to do, but are less willing to actually go the extra mile to write a member of Congress or to be active?
I think so. I think to some degree. I mean, you know, Ryan's question about whether or not the black avatar is enough. I mean, I did it, and it's not, and I wouldn't, it's the only thing that I've really done about it. And really, I became aware of the whole situation because a bunch of friends were in New Zealand and made me aware. And so I changed my avatar, and then people asked me about it, and I told them. So I think, you know, it definitely did raise some awareness. But yeah, I think we are still a very insular community, but we're still a very large community, larger, I think, than we realize. And there's still a lot of education to be done, you know, between, within, you know, inter-geek communication. So I think that it does help for sure. I do think we're less likely to start writing letters or picketing.
It is possible to use these tools to organize. EFF's shown that. President Obama did it very effectively in his campaign.
Definitely.
So the tools can be used to organize.
You know, and we did this with the last Canadian election, two Canadian elections back, where the Liberal member of parliament who'd proposed a really bad copyright law, who was actually my old MP when I lived in Toronto, she lost the election. You know, we did grassroots on the ground, door knocking, organizing to get, well, not, I say we, I was living in London at the time. You know, my colleagues in Toronto did this, and she lost the election by the largest swing of any wow. candidate in the Greater Toronto Area. Like she was just basted by this. And you know, the industry minister, Jim Prentice, the old industry minister, when he introduced a similar law, you know, when he threw like a Christmas constituency party, it was not mobbed, but filled with very polite constituents of his who were nevertheless incredibly forceful on the question of why he'd introduced this legislation. It really put it right front and center on the political agenda.
Well,
you know, what's really irritating me about the situation, though, is the fact that we still don't really have a position in our government, someone who has a voice on this type of topic, right? Obama is supposed to be appointing a U.S. CTO, you know, quote unquote CTO. And that would be a great, you know, it's like when there are human rights abuses in the world, someone in the administration speaks out against that, right? And when, you know, there are things happening internationally that are, you know, indefensible, people speak out against that within the government, but we don't have that. We don't have a voice.
The irony is it's U.S. agencies that are promoting this through
the U.S. trade representative.
Right. so I don't know if we would. I don't know. Do we have the political will to speak out against it when the record industry, the movie industry, and these copyright holders pump so much money into lobbying and campaign funding? You know, and you got David Geffen throwing parties. I don't know if we would have the political will to do that. I wish we would.
But I mean, that's theoretically going to be the job of
a CTO.
States,
yeah.
Right. I mean, that's a position that stands aside from the lobbying and from
the
industry.
So. Yeah.
So that's a position that ideally would be in a position to really speak out against.
And if not, let's throw the sons of guns out.
And here's a real-time interjection from Juha Saarinen, apparently a Finn in New Zealand. The Labour minister introduced the new NZ copyright law. Judith Tizard lost her seat to a nobody in the last election.
Yeah.
So it does happen.
Let's hope so. All right. Well, I got another one to throw at you. This is the Internet Safety Act, H.R. 1076, S-436. These acronyms. The Internet Stopping Adults Facilitating the Exploitation of Today's Youth Act, which would require internet service providers to keep 2 years of records for the benefit of police investigations, but not just ISPs, or really could be broadly interpreted to include hotels, Wi-Fi access points, coffee shops, even home users. Anybody running a DHCP server might be required by this bill to keep 2 years of records available at any time for the police. Now, they always use this, you know, MacGuffin of child pornography, but it's not about child pornography. This is just another.
You can get anything passed in terms of restrictions if you put enough child pornography clauses
right.
in it. Because
if they said this is the record industry retirement fund, they wouldn't go for it.
Yeah, exactly. Well, you know, it's like no congressperson is going to vote against a bill that says, you know, in its lead, this is a bill designed at mitigating child pornography.
The good news is they've tried to get this in 2006. They tried to get it in 2007. It has failed up to now. I really worry when I see these bills introduced.
I mean, even the Bush administration had reservations about this.
That's right. You know? Until Gonzalez said, I want
it. That says something. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, you know what I think the biggest risk to kids from this is that, you know, the only way to make kids safe is not to keep them safe, but to teach them to be safe.
Right.
And the way to teach them to be safe is to teach them to value their privacy, to avoid wiretaps on the internet and so on. And when you tell them, okay, well, what you need to do is whenever you're on the internet, you need to be very cautious of your safety and your privacy and not let people know where you are and who you are and not, you know, be in public when you're saying personal things and so on. And while you're doing that, we're going to wiretap everything you say and record it. And if you take any countermeasures to avoid it, we're going to expel you from school or send you off to internet rehab camp or whatever it is we do to kids these days. You know, kids are pretty good at detecting hypocrisy. And when they detect it, they decide that the person who's saying the hypocritical thing is just lying to them and doesn't need to be listened to. You know, stuffing your face with ding-dongs while you tell them not to eat sugar is not a good way to convince them not to eat sugar. You need to model the behavior you want kids to engage in by wiretapping everyone on the internet and saying you have no privacy and your personal information belongs to everyone. You're fundamentally saying, you know, don't value your privacy. Your privacy has no worth.
It's a depressing thing. Another thing you might want to write your, as Corey, as you say, your Congress critter about and say, we don't want the, we believe in protecting children, but we don't believe in the Internet Safety Act. That's not what it's all about.
There was a great report commissioned by several attorneys general, I think like almost all of them, on the incidents of child predation on the internet, in which they got a bunch of Mimi Ito, Joey Ito's sister at USC, and her grad students to research just how much kids are approached by strangers on the internet to do terrible things to them. And, you know, the answers that they were allowed to come back with were like a lot, a scary amount, and you wouldn't believe how much. And what they came back with was, you know, actually not very much. It's not a big risk. There are risks, which is like kids who are kind of screwed up sometimes try to form relationships with slightly older people, like, you know, kids in their early teens trying to form relationships with people in their early 20s. And sometimes they're successful, and that's really destructive for all parties. And those kids really need help, and that's really bad, and that should really be fixed. And, you know, the attorneys general just, you know, many of them, to their credit, were good about this. But a few of them were like, no, this wasn't an acceptable outcome. You guys are crazy. We need to protect children from stranger danger because that's what they're really at risk from. And it's, you know, it's like protecting them from tyrannosaurs or something. It's not an appreciable risk to kids as opposed to predation from family members and their own lack of appropriate risk containment behavior.
I like to...
Corey... I don't know if this 100% kind of meets with the realities of life today, and that is that there's a huge generation gap in terms of technology. You know, it's hard for parents to teach their kids about you know, how privacy and you know, data is protected on the internet, personal data is protected on the internet, when they themselves don't have a complete understanding of that sometimes. So,
well, that's why they're scared, isn't it? Because it's something.
Right, and that's, I think that's kind of the root of some of these bills. And, you know, they come to pass and, you know, they get voted through or they don't, but they start because, I think, oftentimes because of a fundamental lack of understanding about the way things are versus the way things they ought to be. And, you know, I just know that, I mean, you know, your father, you're very progressive, obviously, you would know exactly how to do this. But I know many, many people who are, you know, in the 20 to 35 age bracket, who are just not as well versed in this stuff as people like us are. And I don't think that they would be in a position to raise their child with such an acute awareness of these things.
Sure. And I think that's why, you know, experts, particularly experts in government, need, when they're asked to do something about what is a real danger, which is kids behaving inappropriately on the internet and exposing themselves to risk, need to come back with, we've hired some experts to go and study, we figured out that these are the risks, we've got a strategy for containing it, and we're going to help you, the parents, and your kids overcome this risk. I mean, it's not just computers. You know, every major technological innovation, you know, that kids were more into cars than their parents when cars were invented, and we needed to kind of sort that out too. And I think that one of the roles of an expert agency, like the entire administrative branch of government in the United States, is to find technical experts to come up with actual solutions, not things that make hysterical people feel less hysterical, but actual solutions to actual problems.
I like the, I'm going to read from your post, Corey, on Boing Boing. This is quoting Dana Boyd, who's one of the researchers that research that you talked about. She says, why are we so obsessed with the registered sex offender side of the puzzle? And she's talking about booting registered sex offenders from MySpace and Facebook. When the troubled kids are right in front of us, why are we so obsessed with the internet side of the puzzle when so many more kids are abused in their own home? I feel like this whole conversation has turned into a distraction. Money and time is being spent on focusing on the and this is really great. Money and time is being spent on focusing on the things that people fear rather than the very real and known risks the kids face.
Yeah. And again, you know, I think that this really comes, you know, this stems from the fact that there is a lack of understanding and that there is this fear and they feel, you know, people who are looking at this kind of thing feel like they can control it through law and through legislation and through, you know, blanket tactics. And clearly that doesn't work. And I think we would all agree on that. But I also kind of understand where that comes from. You know, it comes from ignorance. It comes from not understanding this stuff.
Yeah.
Sure.
Now, you know who should
Dana's amazing, by the way, and everything she's worked on is fantastic. Yeah. And her PhD thesis was just published, and she's got her own lab in Microsoft Research in Boston now, and she's doing amazing stuff.
That's great. That's really great. We'll get back to the conversation in just a bit. I do want to talk about the Pirate Bay trial, if that's what you could call it, circus. And lots more news. But first, I want to remind you that this show brought to you by my friends at GoToMyPC. I say my friends because I've known them for a long time. The guys who designed GoToMyPC, the Citrix folks, have been around. I'm thinking particularly of Ed Iacobucci, who I remember fondly hanging around with CES with Ed. Ed's the guy who did, he was at IBM at the time, did OS2, but I think I don't know if you remember, there was this little thing where IBM helped Microsoft with NT and Microsoft helped IBM with OS2. And Ed really did a lot of the core of Windows NT, as I remember it. And in the process, became an expert on remote access and really on knowing how to do it. That's why Microsoft licenses the Citrix technology. Go to my PC takes advantage of that great knowledge to give you the ultimate in remote access wherever you are, anywhere in the world. You can log into your office computer. It's amazing. Well, here's the deal. You can do it right now. Go to mypc.com/twit. GoToMyPC.com/twit. And before I'm done talking, you'll have it installed. It's really just a couple of clicks of the mouse. Do it now. In fact, you'll get it free for 30 days. So do it now. And then when you travel, just try. You go to the website. You go to GoToMyPC.com. You give them your login, your password. And you have a secure 128-bit encryption right to your office PC. So what that means is you can surf the net, you can open programs, you can send and receive email, you can copy files, all in safety, security. Even if you're at the sketchiest internet cafe in the world, it's remarkable. I mean, you just, and it's fast, it's very easy to use. You can even watch video, it's that fast. Go to mypc.com/twit. PC World gave it their world-class award for best remote access software. They've been doing that year after year. Frankly, I just don't. There are our competitors. Of course, there's even open-source free competitors. There's nothing like GoToMyPC. It's the easiest, the best. And I want you to try it free for the next 30 days. Go to GoToMyPC.com/twit. And if you, especially if you're planning a trip in the near future, you're going somewhere, this thing is amazing. GoToMyPC.com/twit. We thank them so much for making This Week in Tech possible. We're talking with Cory Doctorow of craphound.com, great author, Gina Trapani. What's your new site is, you kind of semi-retired from Lifehacker, Gina?
Yeah. I'm writing on Lifehacker once a week, but my new site is smarterware.org.
And it's a software or just a personal
blog?
Yeah,
it's about
blog?
Software. Yeah, it's a personal tech blog, let's say.
That's cool. Also, Robert Herron of DLTV. And he, of course, does home theater and reviews of HDTVs for Ziff Davis and Ryan Block of GDGT.com. Change of pace. A little bit of a change of pace. Missouri man, 70-year-old man in Joplin, Missouri. His cable went out. He said, no problem. I've got one of those digital TV converter boxes in my closet. Plugs it in. It won't work. He does the most sensible thing. He shoots his TV. Unfortunately, he's arrested for firing an unlawful discharge of a firearm.
I don't know what's so weird about this. I do this every time a product doesn't work for me.
Elvis shot his TV.
This is like routine.
So the digital transition was put off till June 17th. But all they did was say you don't have to the TV stations. You don't have to, but some have. Has there been howls of pain from the stations that have? Have you heard, Ryan, anything from people saying I can't see my TV?
I haven't heard a ton from people writing in stating that they, you know, we do.
Of course,
get,
your listeners know better. I mean,
no, but I mean, we have listeners who work at stations, right? They're the techies who are, you know, keeping the broadcasts online. And I haven't heard a bunch from people who've gotten complaints like that. I mean, I'm sure that they're out there. And, you know, one of the stories that I saw in this week's feed is that 28,000 some odd people, I think, complained to the FCC that their television was no longer working. Wow. You know, I think it's a fraction of a percent. I mean, if you look at, you know, 28,000 people as the total percentage of the United States, you know, it's like 1/100th of a single percent of the population of the country is apparently upset about this.
You sneeze, you're going to get 28,000 calls. I mean,
exactly. Yeah. So, you know, I'm not super, super worried about it. And I know that is, you know, we've talked about this on Twit before. Now, this is going to be an inconvenience for some people, and there's no doubt about that. But it's a temporary inconvenience. It's not something that can't be easily fixed. And although that there, you know, there is a dollar amount associated with fixing the problem, if you didn't get the coupon in time and if you haven't gotten your converter box already, it's not an unreasonable dollar amount, right? I mean, if you have to have television, you know, $20, $30, $40 for a converter box, not going to kill you.
Have you covered this at all, Robert? Have you reviewed digital boxes, anything like that?
Sure. That, and I've also received the main complaints that I get from that percentage of people who haven't made the switch yet are the folks who are really stuck in the analog side of things, where they're using the VHS deck as their tuner. And when the analog signals stop, it essentially becomes a useless brick for them. And they're either unable or unwilling to upgrade to either, you know, something like a digital TiVo device or something else to basically handle their recording. I mean, it's usually the people who are on the least expensive side of things that are feeling it the most.
These are people who are emailing you, right? So they have internet.
Yeah, that's true. At least they do have internet.
Well, I've gotten slammed because sometimes I'll come on the radio show and say, oh, come on, this is little old ladies who are still watching, you know, their 13-inch analog television set who have rabbit ears. And I always get slammed people saying, no, there are a lot of people watching analog TV. If you're in a rural area, you just want right now the best deal in high def TV is free high def TV through the airwaves. There are a lot of people out there.
If you're able to receive, you know, free high def TV ATSC signals, then you're set. You don't have to.
Well, but not everybody can get ATSC. You might have a high def TV that doesn't have a tuner.
So if you have a high def TV, you spent a few thousand dollars on the television.
I guess you're
over
right.
The last couple of years, and you're watching analog television. There's something wrong with you anyway. Of course, they're gonna call you up and be all pissed off at you because they're just not quite doing it right to begin with.
Maybe they haven't.
Some of the other complaints I'm hearing too are the folks that have cable, yet now before they weren't using a cable box, they didn't have to, but some of the cable stations are actually converting to digital, so they're now being quote unquote forced to buy these or rent these or lease these converter boxes. And then they don't get that signal is different from the signal that they're getting.
Because they're not
the
getting locals, you mean? So they're using the antenna for the locals?
Right. Or that's just cable is providing an analog signal.
Well, I think cable's jumped on this. Cable said, hey, we can trick people into, because they've always wanted to get you to buy that converter box or rent
that converter box.
So cable's saying, it's digital now. You need a box. It's just a way of getting in
here. Yeah, you know, there's actually some legislation going through specifically to address this issue, which is that signaling over ClearQuam, which is, you know, basically it's when cable provides you know, free television access, right? It's kind of an alternative to analog television, that they are exactly, as you're saying, taking advantage of the situation and claiming that they have to make this switch on a lot of their channels to digital in order to drive new subscribers. So I don't know. I haven't checked in on that bill for a little bit, and it may have passed, may not have passed, but it is very, very despicable.
So I've got a prediction that about the third weekend in May, we're going to see a huge uptick in complaints about this as people go to the cottage, take their portable TV out to the garage, all that stuff. It's like when they tried to ban smoking in Toronto on January 1st, and it was completely unsuccessful because none of the smokers were willing to go outside on January 1st in Toronto. And then they tried it again the next year on like May 25th, and it was no problem because all the smokers were already outside, and they just didn't let them back in again when it started snowing again the next autumn. It worked like a charm, but this is going to be in reverse, you know?
You know, again, I just have such a hard time feeling pity for people who at this point have not heard of it. I mean,
I don't understand how you could not have heard of it.
I'm not saying the government has done like a really great job of getting this messaging across. I'm sure that most people don't really understand. You know, even people who'd heard of it probably don't have a full understanding of what it all means. But you can't have not heard of this date, right? I mean, this date has been floating around for years. It's been on regular television, constantly seeing commercials for it over the past 6 to 12 months. I mean, you really have to have been tuning everything out at this point not to have heard anything about this over the past few years. And if you haven't, you know, I don't want to see anybody put in a position where, you know, they can't get the information that they need or that there's an emergency or something like that and they don't know what's going on. But look, there are no national emergencies going on right now, as far as I know. And you know, we have to make the switch.
The majority of the complaints I'm getting are really just about, it's not so much the switch. They get that and they understood that it was coming. It was really just the fact that they're realizing how much of their old hardware is going to be rendered obsolete. And that was one part of it. And it was everything from the people who are still using VHS decks and the people who are still using those portable TVs that they take to the ball game. Those were two of the more vocal parts of the community.
Yeah, the portable TV thing is certainly one. But I mean, if you're using VHS deck, you know, just put the converter between your signal and the VHS deck and nothing changes.
Oh, but then you get the arguments about being able to record one channel or
programmability.
It was I was just so wanting to tell this person to just get a TiVo and you're going to be so much happier. Trust me. Just dump the tapes, get the hard drive. You're going
to be. I do try to be sensitive to people who have older hardware, right? I mean, not everybody needs to upgrade every single year.
Well, that's because people like you get accused of, oh, we got to, you know, we're the shiny objects guys.
No, but that's the thing. Yeah, I mean, we get accused of that for sure. But, you know, my thing has always been use what works, right?
Me too.
Don't upgrade if you don't need to upgrade.
I tell people, you don't have to buy a new computer just because everybody else is. You don't have to buy a new computer.
Exactly.
The industry thanks you, but you don't have to do it.
I think at a certain point, if you're using 20-year-old technology, you know, I mean, that's kind of beyond the point of reasonability for support period, right? You can't expect things to be supported forever. Right. The world moves on. We're not burning, you know, petrol lamps in order to keep our houses lit anymore. Right. I mean, we have to build infrastructure and make changes in order to progress.
It sounds like most of the support calls, though. Sorry, not to interrupt, but it sounds like most of the support
Gina,
calls.
Gina, if you don't interrupt, nobody's going to, you're never going to get a word in edgewise. Please interrupt.
I've been figuring that out. I mean, it sounds like most of the support calls were from people who knew about the transition, got the box, and like just didn't figure out that they had to, you know, have it scanned for the digital channels. You know what I mean? It doesn't sound like these are people that were like, you know, freaking out because they weren't ready or they didn't have what they needed. I mean, I don't know what the percentage is, but 20,000 is a big number. And I'm sure it was people that were just like, why isn't this working? I was ready, but now it's not.
You know who really gets screwed is
to point the finger at the consumer electronics industry, which is completely anti-consumer and so unuser friendly. You know, I mean, this could have been a totally brain dead, completely simple thing to teach people how to use.
You know
this
who
hardware.
Really gets screwed? And really, this is a problem. I think you're going to see a lot more of people who are on marginal analog areas that they just don't get a signal in digital areas because, you know, analog degrades more gracefully than digital. And you can actually be getting a signal and it will not work once they go to digital.
And there's no easy way for consumers to know which of the tuners that are available are more sensitive or the most sensitive tuners that are available that will pull in those weak signals easier.
Right. Gina, do you watch Hulu? Do you watch your TV on the web at all?
I do a little bit. I've got a few different setups. I watch stuff on my Xbox 360. I've got a TiVo. I actually have cable, but kind of just because of my living situation. If I could opt out, I probably would and just go straight Hulu.
A lot of people are opting out. Cable is terrified, in fact, that people are moving off of the cable system and trying to use them just as a data channel or not use them at all.
Hulu. Yeah, I mean, this is the economy, right? Why not? If you don't have to pay that bill, why would you?
My cable bill's $100. I can get this stuff from the Pirate Bay.
We've been asking for a la carte systems for a while now from the cable industry, and they're never going to do
that's,
it. So.
That's never going to happen. But so there was that bill. I'm sorry, not that bill. That movement this week on part of the cable side, cable company side, which is basically, you know, putting out this concept for, you know, let there be many Hulus and let them be run by the cable companies.
Yeah. Let us do it, please.
Right. So they kind of, they get to bundle that in with service. So you kind of get the best of both worlds.
That's the Comcast fan. That's that fan idea, right? Where you want, you're on Comcast, but you're watching through their system.
Yeah. It doesn't meet either need, right? Like it doesn't meet the need of letting me cut my cable television bill, and it doesn't meet the need of letting me have all of my great content online, right? It's a half movement in both directions at the same time, and it doesn't meet either need properly. And it, you know, I have a feeling we're just going to keep seeing this from the cable companies until it's way too late for them.
This kind of leaves Corey out, but Hulu, which is, I think, a great idea, and I know a lot of young people. Colleen watches most of her TV on Hulu, has pulled itself off of XBMC, the Xbox Media Center, which, Gina, you've really turned everybody on to. It's a great way.
I love it. I love the XBMC.
But without Hulu, I mean, that's a big, and it also just pulled itself out of Boxy.
Boxy is a fork of the XBMC. Yeah, it sucks. It really sucks. I was trying to figure out, surely there are good business reasons to do it, but from the user side, it's just crappy.
I can't think of a good business reason. The ads are in the video. Don't they want more people to watch?
They said,
if you're going to watch us on a computer, watch Hulu. But if you're going to watch us on a TV, you better not watch Hulu. You got to watch the networks.
Yeah.
I think that's exactly the thinking, right? That's
crazy.
Exactly. Well, it's crazy. But at the same time, if they can't get the same CPM,
there are more ads in the TV version, that's for sure.
Well, there are more ads, but it's also the value of the ads, right? If they stream a show on Hulu, let's say one show, let's say whatever, the latest Daily Show, and they make $10,000 for a million streams, compared that to what they would make on television for a million viewers, which would maybe $100,000 or $200,000 or $500,000. From a numbers standpoint, you can't ignore that, right? You have to say, well, we need to delineate. Granted, it's completely insane, right? For us as users, there's absolutely no reason why we would ever want to watch it on television.
I know,
if we can already have it through Hulu and we're already watching those ads. In fact, we can't fast forward those ads. You know, we have to watch them now.
Right.
But it's just this disparity where you've got the bean counters and they're like, whoa. And
we make more money if you watch it on TV.
These guys are like dysfunctional romantics who won't break up with their current partner until the next one's there.
That's right.
And you know what? That doesn't make either partner happy.
That's right. That's exactly it.
So we've got all you cable refuseniks beat. My wife is a television executive, and we don't have cable.
Do you guys think it's like the first step, though, for like an Uber aggregator service like Boxy, seeing that, okay, they had Hulu, and they could easily add any other online distribution service? Is it really just a fear from some of the content owners not wanting to see that become...
Hulu is not the only service that they have on offer, right? Boxy has deals with Central and CBS. There's a bunch of content on there, a lot of which overlaps with Hulu, some of which doesn't. Their job is going to be going forward, continuing those kinds of deals and continuing to be a platform through which you can get and watch digital media. And they've been pretty good about that so far, and hopefully they'll be able to keep it on. But
Gina, isn't there a hack to get Hulu back on Boxy? I think there is a hack.
Yes, there is. There is. I believe that there is. I actually haven't tried it myself, but my co-editors at Lifehacker wrote it up this week. And who knows how long it'll work. but this just shows you can't
in the long run really fight this. I mean, if you're going to put it out on the web, people are going to figure out a way to get it integrated into their Boxy or their XBMC.
And you have services like Netflix now just moving into more and more set-top devices, everything from the Xbox 360 to Blu-ray players to you name it. And I love that.
So, Corey, what do you do? Do you use iPlayer, the BBC player? How do you watch your, if you don't have a cable connection?
Well, for the most part, well, so we've got Preview. So we got 20, this is what the British did instead of what the Americans did for their DTV transition. They said, we're just going to like light up 30 broadcast channels of standard definition digital television for free forever if you go and buy a converter box. So it's basically get free cable forever if you buy a converter box. So we had a man come in and put an antenna on the roof, but we never watched that either. I mean, for the most part, the TV we're not watching is nowhere as good as the books we're not reading, the websites we're not looking at, the 3-minute YouTube highlights of the TV we're not watching, the games we're not playing. You know, my wife's a former professional Quake player. She plays a lot of games. You know, we just don't have a lot of time in our lives for TV.
That's the fear. It's really not about whether it's on XBMC. It's that people are their screen time is shared with a lot of other compelling content that's not television.
Yeah, and you know, all the numbers you hear about how, oh, people are still watching TV, people are still watching TV, they're watching it as wallpaper. Actually, the Ofcom, which is the bureaucrats who regulate TV here, have coined a neologism. They call it stacking, when you stack your media, which in a game, and you got the TV on in the background.
That's what this is. This is, in fact, I designed Twit Live, the live stream of this stuff, to be stackable. The whole point of it is you're doing other stuff. You put the window behind or you minimize it. You keep listening in the background. It's just kind of chatter. It's somebody keeping you company while you, you know, you work on your bash shell to-do list technology. and if something interesting happens, you switch to it. We're all living in this kind of multi-stream world now. I mean, we're so ADD now.
I have my widescreen computer monitor in front of me, and behind that, across in the living room, is my TV running in the background, just as wallpaper, literally.
Isn't that funny?
Well, the weekend sports, so.
Gina laughed because that's, in fact, her one of her projects.
And I love that you love it, Leo.
I love it!
Because everyone else just kind of makes a kind of blank expression.
It's todotxt.com, right?
Yes, yeah.
T-O-D-O-T-X. Go ahead.
I'm keeping my to-do in a Git repository.
I love this.
Oh,
what is it?
Nice.
It's called Fresh Bake. What is it called?
No, Flash Bake.
Flash
Bake. From my first novel, Down in the Magic Kingdom, the command line from the command line podcast cooked up some Python scripts for me that take all the fiction I'm working on and my to-do list and anything else that's a hot text file on my computer and checks it into a CVS or a Git repository and logs with each check-in. Logs the time on my system clock, the time zone on my system clock, the weather in that time zone according to Google, the last three headlines I wrote for Boing Boing, and I think the next version is going to record the last three songs I listened to on my media player. So it's like it's kind of what was on my mind when I wrote that paragraph in that novel 10 years ago. I'm going to be able to pull that out. The reason I started thinking about it is I met an archivist who told me, you know, with when you're archiving novels, you go through these multiple drafts back in the old days where you could see how the writer changed.
And there was marginalia. You could see what.
Yeah, all of that stuff. And now, like, that stuff just doesn't exist anymore. There's, like, sort of one file that just gets modified as the book starts and the book ends. So I thought, you know, this would be really useful. And then for my todo.txt, you know, I just delete lines out of it as I'm done with them. They often have useful information like phone numbers where I'd love to be able to go back and search that all without having my to-do file grow to, you know, 150,000 lines. So I just keep it in a database now. And it even tells me what day I deleted that line. So I know like when that to-do item's from.
Git keeps track of every change you made. Yeah. I downloaded immediately and then I installed Git on my Mac. But it's not exactly Gina, you need to write it up because I need Lifehacker to explain it.
Yeah, I mean it's a
I think you need to open source this stuff so we can add.
Well, it is open source. You can download it. It's Python code, so you can download it. Yeah.
Yeah,
it's really
myself.
Early.
Yeah, it is pretty early. I'm still figuring it out too. As soon as I get it down to a working, I'll write it up for you, Leo.
It's so cool. And I want to do this. And Corey, now you, one of the neat things about Git is it keeps a full copy of the repository, unlike SVN, in every copy. So
do you
maintain one locally. Do you also replicate it to an external server so it's preserved forever? Or?
That's my next step is I'm going to start replicating it and use the permissions to do things like allow my editor to check out the book as I'm working on it. And then when it's done, allow the public to check out the book.
Oh, I love this.
And even do stuff like typo diffs. So I get sent typos after the book is finished because you never catch them all. And I change them in the electronic file that I make available under my Creative Commons license. And then when the publisher says, well, it's, you know, we're going to do a new edition. You know, we sell out the editions, which is nice. We're going to do a new edition. We're going to back to press. What changes do we need to make? It'll be really nice to be able to say, well, the last one that I checked out for you was on May the 13th. It's now August the 10th. Let's just diff those two versions. There's your list of typos to fix in the next print.
So if you want to read more about this, Corey's written it up on craphound.com, his blog. It's called Flashbake.
And it's on the command lines blog as well. He's a great guy. The next version is going to support plugins too.
Oh man. I think this is a whole system. I love Git. Git is a really great system.
Using programmer tools to do other stuff is like using chef knives to cook, right? It's dangerous. You can really hurt yourself, but they really work. Really, really work.
It's so cool. Well, when I was working on a collaborative novel, we actually did want to set up SVN and have people check in and check out and stuff. Git's better because it keeps a copy in every repository, so you really have like great backup as well.
Yeah.
Good. So, Gina, you know about it and you're working on it.
I am. I'm doing some coding and we're using Git as our repository. Yeah. I'm collaborating with a couple other developers. And up until now, I've always been Subversion, but I'm slowly getting wooed by Git.
I love this idea of having a Git repository that records kind of every, you know, all the little marginalia in your life. And then you can go back. Of course, Corey, I always worry that we're recording all this stuff for posterity, and posterity is going to have absolutely no interest whatsoever in what Grandpa was up to. It's like, oh yeah,
but Grandpa. You know, that's like saying, oh, get rid of all those pot shards. What's the future going to need with those?
Right? Well, you don't know what they're going to need. But think about it. Our generation is going to leave terabytes, petabytes, exabytes of stuff.
That's right.
For the
Charlie Strauss calls it the beginning of history.
Yeah, the beginning of history. Exactly. Go ahead, Ryan.
Oh, I was just saying it's a good thing that storage is so cheap, right? Storage is so abundant, there's no reason not to.
I guess.
So at least if you're storing it for your own benefit, right? Like I take the other side when it's like we should put a CCTV out in front of every building and record everyone who walks past it. But the difference between spyware and malware is whether, you know, you're using tools to find out more about yourself for your own benefit, or whether someone else is, you know, being a creepy curtain twitcher.
Of course, if you live in London, you might as well also get all those pictures of you as you walk down. How many cameras? What was it? 27?
It's 14 cameras per red blood cell now.
I saw an estimate, and this was a year ago, so it's probably doubled. That, like, in your day-to-day life in London, pictures have been taken of you at least 27 times walking around.
Yeah, and they just passed a law making you liable for up to 10 years in prison if you take a picture of a police officer that may be helpful to terrorists. And the police don't want it. The head of the policemen's union was on the CBC last week going, we think this is a terrible idea. What a ridiculous law to pass. Why did they pass this? We don't know how to enforce it. Do we have to go up and arrest tourists now?
Yeah, we have to enforce it.
We've got real work to do, you know?
Thomas Hawk writes about this a lot, where he's just constantly battling. But see, Thomas is aggressive about this. I mean, he really tries to defend the right to take photographs. And it's just amazing how many public places you can't take pictures of. You'll get harassed by the police.
And as Bruce Schneier points out, no one has ever found a cache of photographs in a terrorist lair.
Right.
There's no reason to believe that terrorists take a bunch of photos. You know, unless they're like in a Mission Impossible movie, taking a million photos of the target is not a prerequisite for committing a successful act of terrorism.
Once again, we're spending money to fight the things we fear instead of the actual threats. It's all theater. Pirate Bay. Speaking of theater, Pirate Bay is on trial. It started Monday. I don't even know where to begin on this story. Does anybody want to talk about this at all? The Pirate Bay, of course, the BitTorrent site, the place everybody goes when you're looking for the movie, the TV show, the software. I mean, this is let's admit it, it's the pirate place to get those torrents. Pirate Bay's founder said Peter Sundi Komasnoppi, I don't know how you say his name, but he says, well, we did a survey and 80% of the torrents on our site are legal, which kind of makes it less useful. I thought it's a different Pirate Bay than the one I've been visiting.
You also have to wonder how many of those supposedly non-legal, illegal, 20% are dead torrents or don't work.
Oh, maybe that's it.
Not that I would do a whole lot of downloading or anything, but you know, BitTorrents rarely seem to work as promised. You know, there's never enough peers.
I find it very frustrating. They also talked about a contract that he signed saying he would police the site and saying, well, I didn't read that, so I don't know what it said. It's the strangest trial I've ever heard of.
I think that the coverage on Torrent Freak has been pretty good at kind of pointing out there's just a kind of expectation shear about and reality shear between the prosecution and the defendants here, who they're not doing this because they're lawless nihilists. They're doing this because they've got like an actual developed political agenda about why it's good to share stuff. And But what they also have is an institutional structure that makes no sense at all to the kinds of people who right. can be hired by record labels, because they're like an institutionless institution. You know, they're just a bunch of guys doing stuff. Like, the Pirate Bay is like an emergent phenomenon of beer and Swedes. You know, it doesn't seem to have like it's you know, they're like, well, where did you plan the Pirate Bay? And it's like, yeah, huh? we didn't plan the Pirate Bay. Well, who controls the Pirate Bay? Well, I guess, you know, there's like 9 guys who've got the root right. password, and there's like 15 more have got admin access on this box, and I think we put a box in Romania and we gave a password to that guy. I don't remember.
So you don't think they're obfuscating? This is really how it is.
No, I think this is really how it is. I think this is like the trial of Chicago 8, where they said, you know, you guys conspired to come to Chicago and make a riot. And Abby Hoffman said, conspire? We can't even agree on where to have lunch.
They did agree on where to have the party on the Friday night in Stockholm at the Spektrokopimi party. It looked like a pretty good party.
Sure.
They're not taking this seriously. Do you think they are at risk of getting jailed?
I have no idea. I mean, I don't know what Swedish law looks like, but
store anything illegal in and of itself on the Pirate Bay. It's just torrent metafiles.
You know, my experience of copyright laws is that they often have a very, very high maximum penalty that is at the discretion of the judge. And so it right. may be that they get almost everything thrown out, and there's one technicality on which they're found guilty, and the judge uses the maximum penalty. This is sort of like Capone going away for tax evasion.
Right.
But I don't know. I don't know enough about Swedish law. And they seem pretty confident, but, you know, we've seen confident people come and go. You know, we were pretty confident at EFF about Grokster, and we won that in the appellate division. And I think the Supreme Court were completely, you know, out to lunch. When you read the dicta, they just didn't pay any attention to the law or the argument. They seem to have gone in with their own conclusions.
Do you defend Pirate Bay? Do you think they're doing is defensible?
I think that what the Pirate Bay does is represents a complete collapse of the way that we treat copying. That by treating all copying, including non-commercial copying, as an industrial act that needs to be negotiated by contract between copyright lawyers, what we do is we create this entire outlaw society of people who are vulnerable as a result to being spied on, having their network connections disabled, and so on. And we also fail to compensate artists. And that this is like, it's a bad deal all the way around. I think that it's within the realm of plausibility for Swedes to say, we want to have our own copyright law and we want to exempt this kind of thing. I don't know if that's what Swedish copyright law says. That's what the Pirate Bay people say that it says. You know, the United States spent 100 years pirating all the copyrighted works of the world. You know, their first century of American copyright law was foreigners don't get copyright. The word Yankee comes from a Dutch word meaning pirate, because the Americans were pirating the Dutch China designs, the Dutch porcelain designs that the Dutch had stolen from the Chinese. You know, and every pirate who gets successful wants to call himself an admiral and punish anyone who wants to kind of sink his ship. And so, you know, you have the record industry started off pirating the sheet music people, now calling the people who are pirating them on the internet pirates. Piracy is kind of a natural outgrowth of a disconnection between copyright law and technology. And usually we fix that by changing copyright law to kind of bring the pirates into the admiralty, so that they stop kind of destroying things and instead become part of the status quo. The fact that we haven't done that yet, you know, here we are, whatever, 12 years after Napster, 10 years after Napster, is really shocking. I mean, you know, you've got 30,000 people deprived of their livelihoods by the record industry and no money for artists as a result of it.
Right.
And, you know, who is this good for apart from full employment for copyright lawyers?
I would like to actually go around and ask all of you what you think of Pirate Bay and this trial. Gina, you have an opinion on this?
I don't.
You know, I want to say, you know, I don't want to sound like I'm pro piracy, but at the same time, it's hard not to like these guys.
I dig it.
It's true. It's true. I don't use BitTorrent, and I read a bit about the trial, and I honestly. I think someone like Corey is so much can speak to this stuff so much more intelligently and has so much more experience. I'm just
yeah, but he dodged
agree,
the question too. He dodged the question
Corey.
Too. I just want to say.
You know, I mean, I did find Corey's response to be, you know, pretty interesting and very spot on in a lot of it. But I mean, I don't necessarily think that I agree with this whole disparity between technology and piracy, and that's kind of what moves the industry forward. I mean, yeah, I get that opinion, and I completely see where it comes from. But the point we're at now is, you know, the industry is now in a position that the works that it creates can be taken from anyone at any time without permission, essentially anonymously. And it's arguable that, you know, there's a very big difference, obviously, between cost and value, right? There's no cost associated with that, but there is value that they could argue is lost. That wasn't really as much the case in the past. And so now when we're talking about, let's bring the pirates into the fold, let's you know, push everything forward by, you know, figuring out a way to kind of legitimize all this stuff. Well, I mean, I think that the industry is trying to act on that, right? I mean, if you go back 5 years ago, I really would not have believed if you'd have told me that by 2009, iTunes, the biggest online music store in the world, would be completely DRM free. I would have laughed in your face.
Yeah, you're right.
So, yeah, you know, right. We are going there, but that doesn't mean that piracy has to become normalcy.
Right. So, Ryan, I just say that the jukebox is actually totally parallel to this, where you had jukeboxes were essentially placed by organized criminals. The mafia ran jukebox distributions, putting records into diners and other places, not paying the record companies for it. The record companies had no way to control it. It was totally anonymous. And what they did was legitimize jukeboxes with blanket licenses. That was the origin of blanket performance licenses that are now standard all over the world. So there is a lot of historical precedent for this.
Different, right? I mean, it's different to have a jukebox or to have a radio or to have a device that can play back something on a one-time or a two-time basis, right? When it comes on, so to speak, versus actually having a copy of that media and playing it back whenever you want. You know, again, this is the difference between value and cost.
It's a good point. But jukeboxes, remember, were always commercial too. So it was always someone making money off the record without giving the artist anything. Whereas with file sharing, it's often the case that there's no money changing hands, although it may be happening at a greater velocity. There's no money changing hands. So, you know, they're different, but there are ways in which jukeboxes were far more grave for a rights holder, you know, that there's someone getting rich off your stuff and not paying you than non-commercial file sharing. They're not totally exactly parallel, but there are lots of cases where you had anonymous file sharing or anonymous infringement and infringement that deprived artists of money where we legitimized it because it was just too hard to stamp it out. And, you know, a cold war just kind of bankrupts everyone.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I think that we could probably go back and forth on this for a while. And I do really understand where you're coming from. And I believe in a lot of what you're saying. I just think that we also kind of need to keep it in perspective as well from, you know, the fact that there is an industry that is trying to make money on creating a product. And that industry is obviously changing very quickly. And in fact, my business partner, Peter, has built another company around the concept of, you know, the artist making money from ancillary avenues, either from advertising against the music or from using music as a promotional tool. And that's an actual business with an actual record label. And, you know, clearly these shifts are happening. I just don't think it's quite as tectonic and quite as black and white as saying, okay, well, now, you know, this is how it's, you know, these parallels have been in the past and now it's going to happen again. And, you know, then in, you know, once the pirates have been brought into the Admiralty, so to speak, then, you know, things will be well again.
Robert Herron, you said, I like it.
Well, without a doubt, Pirate Bay's legal page remains just one of my favorite sources of entertainment in terms of just the way they answer the letters.
I
just
agree.
Reminds the world of how copyright law in one country is not the same. Yeah. It's not worldwide in any way, shape, or form. And I'm really curious to see how the result of this trial will either highlight that or perhaps, you know, maybe take another step toward making some sort of a worldwide standard.
Well, we're clearly in a Corey, is this I love how you bring history into this, but is this a typical time or are we in a completely disruptive era where everything's falling apart?
Well, certainly, I think actually, I don't think those two are mutually exclusive. I think it has been typical for a long time for everything to be falling apart.
Okay.
And you know,
well, and there have been other times like this. I'm not where you have these kind of complete shifts in how it all works, but this does seem to be particularly universal.
Yeah, so I think that there are some elements of this that are really atypical. The speed and the globalness of it all are certainly atypical, but the fact that it's disrupting business models totally typical. I mean, you know, my little rap on this goes, first the record companies ripped off the sheet music people, then the right. broadcasters ripped off the record companies, then the cable companies ripped off the broadcasters, and the VCR people ripped off the cable companies, and now the internet is ripping off the companies that made the VCR, like Sony. And, you know, at every stage, they said what we did was progress, but those jerks are doing is piracy. And at every stage, we just, you know, fixed it by saying, well, you know, criminalizing the dominant form of entertainment is probably not the right way to solve this.
Right. So what is the right way to solve this?
Well, so I think it depends by media. Some media, I think you just say, well, you know, die. But back in the Napster days, there were half of Napster's users said that they would pay $15 a month for it. Napster went to the record labels and said, tell us how many billions you want. We'll give you right. that much to be
right.
legit.
Right.
Today, if you want to play music in a club or on the radio, you don't need to license each song. You just buy a blanket license. So, you know, you could imagine that either file sharers or ISPs, and as you say, ISPs can be anyone, including a university or a workplace or whatever, might choose to buy licenses, blanket licenses for their users or for themselves and say, you know, get Earthlink, the ISP that comes with all the music ever recorded using any protocol you want. You collect that music. You disperse it to artists. And there's a guy at Harvard named Terry Fisher who's written some really good scholarly stuff about this, where he kind of breaks down how much money you could expect to collect based on user surveys if you got sort of 50% compliance, and what that would mean if you could disperse that to artists and labels. And you know, one of the things that you can do when you're doing this kind of blanket collection is you can earmark a fraction of it directly to go to artists. And groups like the International Music Managers Federation have done work on what a transparent collecting society would look like. Not one of the old, weird, corrupt ones run by the record labels, but one that was truly 21st century, where everyone could see exactly how that money was being collected and where it was being dispersed. So you wouldn't get, you know, at SoundExchange, you do the web radio did, where they were sitting on all this money. They said, we can't locate these obscure artists. And they finally were forced to name the artist that they couldn't find. It was like Chuck D. You know,
can't find him.
He's
where'd
disappeared
he go?
Off the map. This Chuck D. Does anyone know a
What's
Charles
D stand
D?
For?
That's right. Yeah. We don't have a last name for him.
Well, and maybe that's really the answer, that these Pirate Bays of the world are really just, you know, agents of change, and they're just forcing us to move to these new, better systems, and maybe it'll all resolve soon, I hope.
I like the idea, too, of getting the cost of the media itself out in the open, where people can discuss it and see really what it is, because if you can keep the price low or very reasonable, that really goes a long way, I think, toward just eliminating, you know, rampant piracy in general.
There was a guy it was Canada, I think, who said that it should be a nickel a song.
That, and it also takes away from the whole argument of going, okay, yeah, pointing to the illicit content is somehow a crime rather than the illicit right. content itself and moving that around. It's right. just, there are better ways for all this energy to be used, I think.
Just be glad you're not in the newspaper business right now.
Oh the pain.
Terrible. But, and yet I love that paper newspaper. I mean, how many of you read the Sunday paper and sit down with it and go through it? And
I load nytimes.com.
Do you?
On Sunday.
I do.
you too, Robert, you're an electronic guy?
More so. I'm really hoping that the e-ink type products take off to where you can get a more portable device, that really low power, really durable, you know, a bookish durable. For doing that very thing, you know, away from the computer. Or
Gina, are you seem to me like a cup of coffee, Sunday Times kind of person.
You know, once in a while I do get the paper version, but I have a Kindle. I love reading books on the Kindle.
I guess I'm just an old fart. I think that.
But mostly news, I'm going to go online. I'm just going to check my reader or hit newyorktimes.com. Yeah.
Save me, Corey. You like a paper.
On the weekends, I admit, you know, we spent 2 hours today at our favorite breakfast place, curled up on the sofas while the baby had her nap with the Weekend Observer. I tore stuff out to take home and blog. You'll see there's like 3 or 4 things from the Observer up on Boing Boing today. I do love it. And whenever I get on a plane, a BA plane, I always grab the pink paper. I always grab the Financial Times.
FT, yeah.
And but there's always great stuff to read.
Do you think Posey will be reading a paper newspaper in her adulthood?
I don't know. I mean, I think the future composts the past. So old media tend not to die, but they tend to get sort of folded in. You know, I wrote a column. It's up on it got Slashdotted about 10 seconds before this thing started. So it's up on the front page of Slashdot right now about the future of media. And one of the futures that I talk about that I think often gets ignored is what happened. There's two actual models for semi-extinct media. One is opera, which is basically, it's really expensive and it's sustained almost entirely by rich weirdos and has almost no cultural currency,
exactly.
but will never die. And the other one is poetry, which is really cheap and there's more of it being written ever before. And it's an entirely non-economic proposition. And I think, you know, I can imagine either a newspaper like in the Diamond Age, that Neal Stephenson novel that's, you know, printed on rag paper and ironed by butlers and delivered to rich weirdos, or, you know, a future like poetry, which is what newspapers are looking like now, where there's probably more news and opinion being written than ever before, and it's and being read by a wider audience, but almost entirely as a non-economic activity. And, you know, like, I think as a matter of policy, if we're going to, like, make a technology policy to promote newspapers, it should be to promote newspapers, not to promote the profitability of a newspaper company. And so long as we're getting newspapers, I think, and we like the newspapers we get, that should be enough. You know, it's like, it's not the government's job or policy's job to ensure that, you know, that the industrial heirs of William Randolph Hearst forever put a quarter in their pocket every time you find out what the weather is.
Well, the only problem there, though, is that there is actually a great disparity between a non-economic media and the newspaper, you know, capital. And that is, it costs a ridiculous sum of money to print a paper, right? So you can't have a non-economic media offline, right? That has to exist on a device on the internet. It has to exist in a medium that is not costing on a per printed basis, right? So I don't disagree at all that obviously, you know, this media is going online. It's going that direction. I mean, that's what Gina and I have made a career out of, is bringing our respective medias online and being obsessive over it and, you know, trying to kind of redefine that small amount of space. But what it really is, you know, New York Times is going to have to kind of undergo a shift at some point where it has to make the decision, do we keep the legacy paper, right?
Sure. Someone asked Clay Shirky last time he was here in the UK, do you think your kids will read printed newspapers? And he said, sure, they'll have printers.
Great answer. You want the Sunday Times? Print it yourself.
You know, yeah. I once stayed with my wife and I, we review hotels sometimes for this guide to hotels to go for romantic weekends called the Mr. and Mrs. Smith books. We get a free weekend in a hotel and we stayed in this really swanky high roller suite in Las Vegas at the MGM once. And they had like 170 daily papers. They had a service that printed them out on giant sheets of, 11 by 17.
Oh,
and then
cool.
They bound them in silk ribbons and they delivered them to your room. And the suite came with a butler. And the butler would come and lay out your papers and make your cappuccinos for you in your living room. Unfortunately, we only got two nights there, but we read a lot of newspapers. It was pretty cool.
Now that is luxury. That's the way to do it. I love it.
It's Vegas, baby.
What? I don't know if Vegas has. Does Vegas have that?
I don't know. Is Vegas.
That was Vegas.
That was Vegas?
It was the MGM Skylofts. It's where they put the whales. So if you've got $1,600 a night to spend in a suite,
that's
your suite, man. Pick you up at the airport in a Mossbach and take you to the 78th floor. And there's a guy who takes you to the front of the taxi line when you want to leave the hotel. It's all very swanky. Not that we could ever afford to do this on our own, but if someone else is footing the bill.
What fun. That sounds fantastic.
Yeah, it was pretty awesome.
Cory Doctorow is at craphound.com, CRAPHOUND.com, and of course, everywhere else. I mean, is that article that you were talking about that's on the front page of Slashdot is and very good. Actually, that was what kind of prompted my question about the New York Times is on the InternetEvolution.com site.
Yeah, that's Information Week's site.
Oh, I didn't know that. This is the first time I've seen it. I'm going to be a regular because this is a great looking site. Very interesting site. Thank you for joining us, Cory. It's great to have you on the show. I really appreciate
Thanks.
It. We'll have you back soon. Mm-hmm. Also, Gina Trapani from lifehacker.com. Great to have you once again. The website is
smarterware.org.
That's
my personal site.
That's the one you want to plug. Smarterware.org.
Yeah, sure. Sure. Yeah. Thank you so much for having me. This is a lot of fun. It was nice being the fifth and final Cylon.
We now know. She's got those lights that go up and down her spine. We know that. We know the truth. It's out there. Smarterware.org. And also, that's don't forget the todotext.com. And I'm going to look for your write-up of Flashbake. I need that badly.
Oh, yeah. I'm totally trying out Flashbake.
I need that badly.
I am so there.
Ryan Block does a podcast at GDGT. Soon we'll be unveiling something new there, a community of sorts. I guess.
We've got a site coming. I don't know when it's going to be out. But
it's
going to
be fun with Peter Rojas. Peter will be on the show soon. I wanted to get him on too, but it would have been too many people. It's great to talk to you again, Ryan. I really appreciate it.
Ryan, you know what you need until you launch is one of those under construction animated GIFs.
Yeah, we were totally thinking about, you know, the little guy with
guy in a hard hat with a shovel. Yeah.
Yeah.
And throwing bits over his shoulder.
Yeah. And email us in a mailbox that opens up. And
I'll get on that right now.
I'm sure the Wayback Machine has some samples you could use. And Robert Heron, what's DLTV is not dead, not forgotten. We'll be coming back, I hope.
No, same. Yeah, I do. It should be. We're working on it right now. It's all in the process of just putting things back together and getting the people we need to get it done right. So, and on top of that, we're still doing things like Extreme Text podcasts and the other video work we do. And of course, I'm always doing my home theater and HDTV stuff.
Is there a good site besides DL.TV to go to see? I know they have the buying guide and everything on there. Is there another site you'd like to?
The PC Mag site for anything HDTV related. I mean, my reviews are all up there, and I get to see just about everything in terms of what's afoot in the home theater space.
Can you believe Pioneer getting out of the business?
That made me cry. I just hope that companies like Panasonic license the technology that was exclusive.
That Kuro technology.
They were 2 or 3 years ahead of everyone else, but they just weren't making any money at it in the way the sign of the times. But Vizio also announced they're getting out of plasmas as well, so... You know,
it's the end of plasma TVs, or are we going to...
No, not at all.
They are
it's a minor...
a lot like our conversation from a few episodes.
Well, you know, Ryan, I got to ask you now, because you, at that time, said Pioneer's dead, they're out of the business, and we all said, no, they're in the business, they're just having Panasonic make their panels, and you were adamant. Did you know something?
I'm not going to say what I didn't.
I think you knew something, and you just have forgotten.
You can tell things sometimes, and
you're right.
Are going so
you're right.
I agree with Robert though. I don't think it's dead, but it's not looking good.
Oh, I love
that. Was a sign of the times at CES when, you know, Pioneer didn't show up with any TVs, and you're like, okay,
that's weird, isn't it? Yeah,
that was. But they have the best stuff going, but there are other companies out there who can pick up the ball and run with it. So,
do you remember, Robert, when we built the ultimate gaming machines?
Oh, yes. The giant monitors.
You got to see this one we built. Colleen really gets the credit for it. We built the ultimate gaming machine. Quad core 9770 in it, not one, not two, but three 280 cards, GFX 280. So it's tri-SLI. This thing has dual velociraptors in RAID 0 for ultimate speed. It is the ultimate gaming machine. We estimate we put more than $10,000 into this. We are giving it away, and you have one more week, kids, to win it. Now, here's the deal. Here's how we're giving away, and I'm not going to put any restrictions on this. We're doing what I call a 10-5-1 contest. You email me, ugum@twit.tv is the address, ugm@twit.tv, with your 10 reasons why you should win it. We wanted to make sure that whoever wins this really can use it. This thing is a killer. We're going to bundle it up with games. It's just awesome. You can, all the specs are at inside.twit.tv. Colleen's been writing this up. Water-cooled system. We're overclocking the thing to over 4 gigahertz. It has the fastest benchmarks I've ever seen on a stock machine. This thing is, it's not stock. It's incredible. So you send us the 10 reasons why you want to win this to ugum@twit.tv. We, the Twit crew, will select the 5 best, what we consider the 5 most creative, most interesting. It could be text, it could be video, it could be a song, whatever you think on those 10 reasons. We're going to pick the 5 best and then let the audience vote on them. And then we will, actually, Colleen will come to your door with Ugum because she has to, you know, it's water cooled. She has to put it all together. And so wherever you are in the world, you will get Ugum. You'll get the ultimate gaming machine. It'll be all yours to keep with that 30-inch Dell display. It is something. It is gorgeous. So you have till February 28th, midnight, February 28th. To get your entry to ugm@twit.tv. I just want to, I haven't plugged it on Twit at all yet, and I really wanted to make sure you knew about that one. If you can't send video through the mail, you just send me a link, or you put it on YouTube, or that's fine. You don't have, you know, there's lots of places you can put that video up. Don't send me the attachment. Just send me a link to ugm@twit.tv. You can hear the shows at iTunes, of course, all of our Twit shows. And don't forget live.twit.tv. I apologize to those who came in early and couldn't get online. We are, of course, perfect timing. As soon as we started Twit, the server went down. Not StickAm. StickAm's been great, but my own server, the twit.tv server. Hope you enjoyed watching the show. Thank you all for joining us. We'll see you next time. Another Twit is in the can. Round the horn.